Mini episode 1921 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at Sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode 1921. The crew is back together here. You had us previewing the NFL draft last week. We're back to recap it here. In between, we did a draft night show. Rick Morris, Jason Jones, Chris Galloway, one of the longest running cohesive draft analysis teams out there. We've been doing this since 2012 together on the FDH Lounge. So just 5 years shy of how long the show's been on. It's been the three of us continuously doing this on draft night. I want to send a special thanks to others from the FDH Lounge family who were on the show. Russ Cohen, Bob Glassman, Joe Stazak, Ben Chu, with a little cameo from the Portland nightlife at the end of the proceedings here. So it was a great, fun night. We're going to be here to break down everything that happened. But as I alluded to off air, I want to start by getting into a couple of macro level issues, and these are things that we really shouldn't have to cover, but I think we do because some of them have been called into question out there a little bit. Jason and I talked about this. Chris, I don't know if you caught any part of this, but the reporter at the press conference who asked John Lynch why he always reaches, and then that spawned a whole thing. And before you know it, Warren Sharp and everybody else is doing these exposés over the years. Were you privy to any of that? I imagine that you were.
A little bit of that, yeah. Just the sort of the tail end of it when I jumped on. That you guys were talking about.
But I mean, I don't know if you saw any of this as it was happening the last couple of days. It was pretty amusing because it one question at a press conference, one reaction to it, spawns this whole thing of like, huh, let's do a deep dive. A lot of people were doing that simultaneously. And then it was like, oh my God, look at what they've done over the last decade. And the degree to which I know Kyle Shanahan is involved a lot in the procurement process here. So we've seen this before in sports of where, you know, the GM is undermining the coach, but they're the same guy. I mean, I know that John Lynch is technically the GM, but like, imagine if Kyle Shanahan, the player procurement guy, had a better brain, because Kyle Shanahan, the coach, is damn good. And we're now learning, as we look at this, just how much he's had to overcome. And the record of this, and John Lynch openly saying, we don't mind going outside the consensus. We have our own board. We have, and I said to Jason prior to the show here, I'd always had a weird feeling about San Francisco over the years, but now I can like put my finger on it a little bit more. This is a perfect example on our post-draft rankings. By the way, find us on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com. We're going to have this up on the screen for part of the show here tonight, the 2026 FDH NFL post-draft rankings. We'll get into this. San Francisco only 30th on the value spectrum for how they did in the draft off of the Jason Jones top 100 players. In needs, they were tied for ninth. So they went out, and they did a very respectable job of addressing their needs. They just did it with a bunch of guys that they reached for. And this whole thing of, like, all the people who love to demagogue is it takes 3 years to even know what a draft class is going to look like. And it's like, here's the thing, though. If you're within the general consensus, right? I mean, like, there's Jason's player rankings. There's his mock draft. There's my mock draft. We're all within the consensus because we understand market value. And the classic thing with fantasydrafthelp.com we've talked about from day one is value. Okay? You have to understand this. You have to understand where the market's at. To completely disregard the market and say, we're just going by what we think, screw the market. That's a thing where, again, I just, there are no words for this. They're like, you know, we had a guy, we've had a guy on and off. Well, he's deceased now, but a guy who had been in our fantasy baseball league for many years. My friend, the late, great James Evans, with his team, the High Plains Drifters. He was famously a guy who was like, I'm going to take guys wherever I want to take them. He actually won, I think, like two titles. The other years, yeah, not so good. If it wasn't a title year, it was not going to be a very good year. And that's how it goes. You can have outlier things. And he was like one of the smartest baseball guys I've ever known. So
let me address this in two ways.
I want to know what you think first, Chris. Yeah, because like when we talk about the market, Chris Galloway can expound on that all day long, regardless of the subject.
I think the traditional way that when teams put together their board, they don't try to reach in terms of where they think the player is going to go based on where they think other teams have them valued.
Okay. Yep.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And therefore, if you somehow thought Mendoza was a day three pick, right? You're like, whoa, what did the Raiders do? Right. But you, that means you're not reading the room. Mm-hmm. I watched San Francisco's draft and I kept thinking, when are they doing that? You know, that's a strange pick there. There were some other guys in this draft individually with teams where I questioned the how and the why of where they drafted them. There were times in the past when the Browns had drafts like that. You know, when you were a fan, you would scream about, you know, why are we taking this person in the second round when they have a fifth round grade on them?
Sean Thompson.
So, yeah. But I would also say this. So, yeah, I think there's some truth to their board and how they see guys, and therefore, and if they've decided they want that person, then they're going to go ahead and pick them wherever. But I think we are going to see a shift, and I think this is the more important conversation, not what's the value where, you know, are they end of the first round or middle of the second round? You're sort of nitpicking there. I think the thing that I saw in this draft, rounds 4 through 7, was the first draft that I saw that I think was affected by NIL, in the sense that teams are trying to evaluate players. Scouts are trying to evaluate players. And, you know, you're not spending as much time with certain players, more time on other players. And then a bunch of people aren't coming out, because they're getting good money to stay in college. And if you can get $500,000 to stay at TCU versus getting, you know, $700,000 to go to the NFL, you might stick around another year in college where it's a little easier, life is a little better, and you have a chance to maybe over the next year to improve your stock further in the next draft. And so I think what you're going to see out of NFL teams is a lot more guessing, more wild projection, and a lot more variance on boards when you get to rounds 4 through 7 on teams, because of the NIL effect, that they're going to have a harder time giving a grade and analyzing some of these guys that they haven't spent as much time on. And you're just going to get some reaches, even in places like, you know, I know in the later rounds, it's always, you know, a reach, you know, you never really know, but you're going to start to see a lot more variance there, I think. And I think this is the first year we saw NIL affecting that and how teams were going about their draft. I think they were still pretty comfortable in rounds 1 and 2, and then it starts to change. And I think we saw that with the run on tight ends, specifically your Miami Dolphins taking OU, OSU, Will Kaczmarek in the third round in the top 90, right? Yeah. There is nobody on projections that had him going before the fifth round. And right, at the earliest, some had him as a seventh rounder, I saw. Now, I watched that player for 4 years, both at OU and OSU, and had a much higher opinion of him because of that. But that's an example, I think, and you're going to see more of that going forward.
Jason, by the way, Chris, that's an amazing point. Jason, please follow up on that. And then I also want to get your thoughts also on what Chris also said about awareness of value, because that on these players, awareness on what the marketplace is on these players, because that's where you can extract your, you know, your edge is by maximizing your knowledge of where other teams have them. But that part and the NIL, I certainly want to hear your thoughts on.
So real quick, I didn't know that's where you were taking this.
I saw you perk up when he said that.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a funny screenshot that could be had there. Okay, so I've written a piece. It's not published yet, but it should be out today or tomorrow. And I just want to give a PSA to literally anybody that's watching this, and then we'll get to answering your questions. I'm so beyond tired of hearing people say, draft grades don't matter. And then that is typically followed up with, it takes 3+ years to figure out what these players are. Let me just say this to the entire draft watching world. Draft grades are exactly what they sound like. They are grades about the draft, or more specifically, the draft strategy. And here's the interesting part. If you draft a player, wherever you take him, right? And then somebody says, well, we don't know what that player is going to be. Here's the kicker. 3 years from now, if that player is an all-pro or if that player is out of the league, does not change the draft grade one bit. Because we're not projecting how good these players are going to be. We're grading what the team did in order to acquire that guy. And that goes into a bigger thing where the draft is a puzzle to create the – greatest collection of talent you can get. It's not a race to the number one guy you have on your board. So just in general, please understand, draft grades are draft grades. What the players become or something different, those two ideas don't mix. So when we say draft grades, or we say we don't think that San Francisco did the right thing, we're not saying the player's going to be bad. We're saying how they go and about getting them is questionable.
That you left a lot on the table to get them.
For example, and I'm sure we're going to talk about this later, Emmanuel McNeil Warren. Mm-hmm. That is going to be regarded as a great pick, not because Emmanuel McNeil Warren is a lock to make 8 Pro Bowls. It's because the consensus was he was somewhere between teens and like pick 40. No one saw him available later. So when you come in and get him in the third, that makes that pick great. It has nothing to do with the player or how good he's going to be. Anyway, now that I've said that, Chris hit the biggest storyline of this draft that most people are not thinking about or considering. I have this opinion that we saw the reaches we did, and we saw names. I'm going to tell you right now, there were at least 50 names on day 3 that I didn't even look at. Like, they weren't even on anyone's radar, and they came out of nowhere. And I'm not talking about Uar Bernard, who's from Nigeria and never played football before. I'm talking about real football players that we just didn't hear in the conversation. And the reason for that is what Chris is talking about. It is more advantageous for the player, unless you're a lock to be like that dude, it's more advantageous for the player to stick back. Now, going into this draft a year ago, we thought we were going to potentially see Arch Manning, Dante Moore, maybe even someone like Sorsby, who's in a bit of a situation right now. None of those guys came out because it's better for them to stay. They're going to get more development. They're going to make their money, whatever. And what we're going to have is a growing situation where the elite dudes at the top are going to go at the top. And we're going to reach a point in most drafts, and it could be the second round, could be the third round, whatever, depends on each draft crop, where you're going to go, who are these people? And it's because the transfer portal and NIL affords a new dynamic we've never had before, and these teams can take their time and look at players differently and value them differently. So I think Chris is absolutely right. This is the first draft we've seen that is dramatically impacted by NIL, and that's not going to go away anytime soon. And to be honest, as NFL fans out there watching, you should like this. Like, I know the initial thing is, well, in this draft, I wanted all these players. Well, half those players aren't in this draft. So if you can get used to that, the idea is we're not going to have these guys that go get drafted because they got a bunch of hype the year that they got drafted. And then you get them and you're like, oh, this guy doesn't understand high level concepts. You're not going to have that. These players should come in and be better. And it's reciprocal. Now basketball is a different conversation. I don't know how that's really going to work as well. But I do think the biggest storyline of this draft beyond players and teams is how NIL has affected it.
Well, that's an amazing follow-up on your part, Jason. And something that, again, as Chris mentioned before, as far as a former Bobcat player who had been taken, I want to get to the other macro-level point that I'm going to make before we get into some of the specifics on the draft. And this one being, I'm going to touch upon, Chris is in my alma mater down there at Ohio University, the Harvard on the Hocking. That unfortunately for the kids now, they're not too far away from final exam time. Quite frankly, it was better when we were there, when it was on quarters. There's no place like Athens in the springtime, baby. You want to be there until early June. These poor kids now. But I digress. Okay, when you're taking your final exam, you reach the point of pencils down. That's where we are, people. Pencils down. It's exam time. We might as well start the season tomorrow. Figuratively, I know everybody needs to still do their offseason work and whatnot, but like AJ Brown is probably going to go to the Patriots, and there might be one other outlier move here or there. But the meal's been cooked. The rosters are in place. There's going to be the final cutdowns. Some teams are going to, you know, say one man's trash is another man's treasure, either post June 1st or in training camp when there's cuts. But if your team didn't do what it needs to do to contend for next year, too late. I talked about this with Chris before, that catching a part of a Cleveland area podcast that has a lot of goofy crap on it, of where somebody last summer in August was like, I'm not giving up on the season now. And I made the point when we did the divisional previews last August, you're either ignorant if you say that, or you're pandering for clicks, because science tells us that basically you're locked into a range at this point in time. Now, we'll talk about this later on, and there is a feature I do in the fantasy football guide that comes out later on in the summer, the top 10 players on the spot in the NFL for this year. One of the top ones on that list is going to be Shedeur Sanders, because this would defy Chris's expectations and my expectations. But if he could break out this year, if he could be worthy of the first-round pick so many people saw him as a year ago, it's a winnable division. Chris and I talked about this over the weekend. Like, the Browns could be an outlier in this regard if he does the thing that so many of us don't expect him to do. Okay.
You guys are having Shedeur conversations and I'm not involved?
Well, that was by mistake, Jason. That was clearly by mistake. But it's like, he's an example.
It was more of a side comment than a conversation. Let's be clear.
Side comment, yes. Now, about that, it's a winnable division, and that's the whole thing. Is that I make this list every summer, the top 10 players on the spot of, and generally what that is the team didn't do anything in this one area. So this guy better step up. Shedeur Sanders is going to be very high on my list here because he's the classic example of what I'm looking at. The Browns are basically letting it ride at quarterback. And we're going to see how that plays out. Most of the time, right now, you're locked into a range for the season. There will be teams that defy that. But as with teams that don't draft for value, we're talking about outliers. And being that we are a scientifically based group that doesn't believe in outliers as the norm, again, to hope for your team being that much more than what the roster says it is at this point in time is generally futile. I'll start with you, Jason, for your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I absolutely agree with that idea, especially with Shedeur Sanders. And I think once we go over the stuff that they did in this draft compared to what they did last year in this draft, he's in a position where, like, I'm not saying, you know, do the business or get off the pot, but the pieces are there now, right? What did we say all last season? He didn't have weapons. The offensive line is bad. They went out and got, you know, a consensus great left tackle, and they gave him two weapons that Barry has not done here ever. He's never drafted somebody that high at receiver. So I totally agree with the Shador part, but that's, you know, my confidence in it comes. Yeah, watch him get comfortable, though, and see what happens. Now, I want to give, to sort of piggyback on your point, I want to give a different example where this played out in real time, and I was flabbergasted at the volume of fans that didn't get the problem. So we get to training camp-ish of last year, right? And it becomes apparent that the offensive line is not good. And then when they start the season, not good. And then people are going, oh, they got to get offensive line help. They got to get a receiver better than Jerry Jeudy. Who are they going to add? What are you talking about?
Right.
It's August. Yeah. There's no adding at this point.
Right.
So to your point, if we're talking about someone that you get to the draft and they kind of didn't do what they needed to do to make the roster in a position where you actually hope for some good things to happen, that's what we saw last year. That's why anybody to – again, talking about the podcast that we won't call by name, during the season, talking about winning 10 games or I'm not giving up on the season, what are you even talking about?
Yeah.
I think all of us here knew once the season started, we knew what it was going to be. And that's why I kept saying the best thing for this team is to start cycling through these quarterbacks. Get Dylan in there, see what he's got. Get Shador in there, see what he's got. Because this is not a season that they're going to win anything. And you can say the ball will bounce how it does. No, it won't. No, there's a base understanding that your roster has to be in a certain position. And it wasn't for them, which is why 3, 4, 5, 6 wins at the most is what we were talking about. We were talking about that probably this time last year. So, yeah, to the point of, you know, the whole optimism, like, oh, I'm not giving up yet. Yeah, you're being ridiculous because we've seen enough, whether you're talking about like an individual level or just in general, we as football viewers have seen enough to know when it's not going to work.
And exactly.
There's a few teams in this draft where you kind of hope they're doing like a 2-year plan because this wasn't it.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear who some of the teams are. They're tanking for quarterbacks for next year, and we'll get into that a little bit more. No, that's something quick. I can at least see that. I can at least understand that. That makes sense.
Real quick,
because this was a one-quarterback draft.
Yeah, like that's what this was. Mm-hmm. Now, if we assume everybody that matters has a good 2026, let's say, right? Yeah, people are going to be gunning for Arch and Dante Moore. There are 10 quarterbacks that could be in next year's draft that you look at, maybe they're not the franchise guy, but they're a legit starting option for a stretch of time. And from a draft perspective, when I look at that, I'm sitting here, you know, admittedly as a Browns fan, thinking I really need Shador to work out because if you go into next draft and you have any capital whatsoever, and you've got the Jets with 3 first-round picks. They're going to trade up to number 1. And then there's going to be another team that's going to mortgage the farm to move up to number 2 or whatever. Now we start to see some things falling in. And my brain goes to, but if Shador is good enough or is the guy or whatever, can we Ditka this damn thing and go get Jeremiah Smith? So there's some interesting concepts. And he's not the only one. The Auburn kid that transferred, Coleman. Like he could be nasty. If the Ryan Williams in Alabama gets his stuff together, he could be another one. So
my dad, if he were here right now, would be saying, how has Julian Sands' name not come up yet?
Well, because he's a quarterback and the premise is I'm hoping we're not worried about quarterback.
I just feel like you're talking about the ones before though, but yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So I mean, to make Papa Morris happy, take Arch Manning, Dante Moore, Julian saying, throw him in a tumbler and you decide who it is.
Sellers, just kidding.
One of those three is going number one, and there's an argument to be made for saying.
Yeah.
I think we talked about this in the pre-show. There's an argument to be made for saying over all of them right now.
Maybe. We'll see what he does this year.
Argument to be made right
now. It's not impossible. It's not impossible. I agree with you on that. Chris, let me get your thoughts on all of this.
First of all, and I know I'm in the minority. I'm not convinced the starting quarterback isn't going to be Deshaun Watson. You know, they are paying him the most. He's the only quarterback on this roster that's ever done anything in his career. Now, do I think that right now, to me, it's a coin flip, whether it's him or Shadur. I don't think that it is, going to be Shadur with Watson. I think it's more likely Watson starts the season, and if he stinks after four games, Shadur comes in to finish the season. Let me just say this.
Jason, I would just say, shoot that shiz into my veins if it's Watson day one.
But
booed at the opener.
I want to point out that what I'm saying doesn't counterdict your point, mm-hmm. which is I think that based on what you said, Rick, the roster that the Cleveland Browns have now, as an example, is better than the roster that they had last year.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so you're going to take a 5-win team, right? And they're playing these rankings are based on last year, but they are playing a much easier schedule this year than what they played last year, at least on paper. So now you've got an easier schedule, a better offensive makeup with basically the same defense, and you won 5 games last year. My message to Browns fans is if Watson and or Shadur are playing as the 23rd or 4th best quarterback in the league, they're probably going to win at least 7 games this mm-hmm. year, probably 7 games. So there's no top 3 quarterback coming. They're going to be like the 10th pick in the draft, mm-hmm. maybe the 11th pick in the draft.
I expect them to earn a high pick with their quarterback play, though, Chris.
Well, I understand that. And understand something. Their quarterback play last year was beyond garbage, Rick, and they won 5 games.
Yeah.
And there are 2 other games I could argue that they should have won with an offense that was beyond morbid. Mm-hmm. And so, I would argue that you say, I expect them to, earn that number one pick. They're not going to. Not with this defense, and I know defenses don't automatically translate year to year. That's other than those early aughts Ravens teams, 99 to 2004, defenses 1 year could be here, the next year they're here, they're up and down. I mean, it could be the same damn people, and they can vary a lot. So, but if this defense is close to what it was last year with an improved O-line play, and again, I don't know that the O-line play is going to be that much better. I don't think they're going to be the worst. They're probably going to be more like close to the middle of the pack, right? Judkins gets a full summer camp. Remember last year, he didn't get one. He's healthy. You've got more wide receiver. You've got a new system that I think is more catered to Shadur and Deshaun in this new offense. So I think it's more likely they win 7 games than they win 2. And so I think Browns fans, to Jason's point, this is not about a quarterback. This next year is about what other weapons can they get. And then they're going to have to go into free agency or I don't know where and figure out the quarterback thing. Because it's probably not going to happen for them in the top 10 picks unless they can convince the owners to, let them trade 10, 12 years worth of picks. So, I'm in agreement. I just don't see it quite the same way in terms of how I think it's going to play out for a team like the Browns. But on the macro of what you're talking about, mm-hmm. you are right, Rick. Your roster is your roster. Barring a couple of camp pickups, post June 1 cuts of veterans for salary cap, maybe a player, your team isn't changing. It is what it is right now, 98%. That's your roster.
What they should conclude with, they do the Mr. Irrelevant ceremony at the end of the draft. That should be the penultimate part of the draft. Yeah, they should do that. And then the very last image that you should see up on the Jumbotron there is good old shout out to the Macho Man here. Have him saying, it is what it is. Because that's where we are right now. It is what it is. And I'm sorry, you were about to make a point, Jason.
Yeah, no, I just, as the arguably biggest Shador guy in media that is not, you know, in Dion's pocket.
You covered him.
I just feel obligated to just say three quick things. The money is an argument for years one through three. Mm-hmm. The moment they said it was a swing and a miss, I don't buy the money thing anymore. You have to pay it, but who gives a shit? And then the physical part. We've never in the history of football seen somebody come back from two Achilles injuries. And the player that he was, we've never seen. So we're now 7 years removed from Houston Watson. So I'm just saying, as a public service announcement to everyone, just so anyone watching understands where my stance is, I have no desire to see Watson actually walk out onto the field unless it's like Shador's in the tent or something. And I'm actually worried to see what would happen if he wins that job, because boos on game one are going to be the very short end of it. Like, I'm not saying people are going to riot, but people will stop watching. Like, he's disliked that much that I don't think there's a rational way they can actually put him out there and sell that this is a good thing. Anyway, that being said,
if that happens week one, I fully expect somebody to screen cap my face from right now, and you'll be seeing it on Twitter, and it'll say underneath that some people just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah. Anyway, and I'm more than happy to admit that I have a Shador bias.
I don't think Todd Monken gives a rat's ass about any of that. I think he's going to play who he thinks is his best quarterback. If he thinks it's Dylan Gabriel, I think he's going to play him. Now, I don't think it's going to be, but my point is that Monken doesn't own any of it. And again, I think we've already seen in his short tenure, if his evaluation is that Deshaun has the better understanding of the offense and he's reading it better and he's, you know, going through progressions better, whatever you want to call it, that's who he's going to start. Now, again, I don't know anything. I just think it's a coin flip right now is all I'm saying, because I know Shador fans aside, you know, I know he's the greatest thing since sliced bread, right? But what I saw last year was a shit quarterback. And 2 years prior to that, I saw shit Deshaun Watson. So I don't think we have our quarterback on this roster, period.
The only thing I want to say to that, And there's nothing wrong with anything you said, is Monken can come out there and say he's playing better and we're going to start him. And if the post-game press conference, he's asked, will Deshaun start next week? And he says yes, and they have 20,000 people in that stadium. At what point does someone step in and go, like, I get it, but we're burying the lead here. Like, what are we talking about? So I just think that particular – now, you want to say Dylan goes in and earns it? I'd hate the idea. But I think that's more sellable than Watson plays. But that's just – I'm pulling from just, like, the fans. And you're right. Monken doesn't give a darn about that. So the only question is, would the owners step in and say, it's your team, but, like, we can't have this?
I don't think so. Because I know what Jimmy Haslam said, but Jimmy Haslam was at Deshaun Watson's wedding, right? Deshaun had him there, right? Jimmy seems to actually like Deshaun on a personal level.
That reception must have been nuts. So I've never heard of one that had a massage table station.
I don't think you're going to see that. I mean, I truly think one of them is going to be the starter, and – you know, all I'm saying is I just think it's a coin flip as to who it is at this point. I think that, you know, their flaws, the two guys, is well documented what their flaws are for both those guys. Well, all three. I would love for Shador to become this season the 20th best quarterback in the league and to show progress and to get better and to throw for 3,800 yards and 19 touchdowns to only 11 interceptions. Or I would love to see that progress. The problem I have is it, based on what I saw last year, I don't see that happening. So I'd love to be wrong, obviously, because it'd be great for my team. And I would love for Shador to become the quarterback so many people believe he is already. But we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if what you outlined happens, that's the ideal situation. We as a collective spectators, if you will, so I'm including everyone from the aunties who are not football fans, all the way up to people like us that have been doing this for an exhaustive amount of time and have a sample size that we can lean on. No one should be looking at this like, can Shador start the Pro Bowl? Can Shador be the best quarterback in the league? Don't do that.
He is a Pro Bowl quarterback after all.
Well, yeah. That's why I said start. Said start the Pro Bowl, which means he would have been one of the best quarterbacks.
Uh-huh.
We don't need that. We need him to fall somewhere between 10 and 20. Now, 10, I think, is still a little bit high. But if he's the 20th, the 19th, the 18th best quarterback, the defense will do what it does. The running game will do what it does. And now we're having a conversation, you know, in eight months from now. And we're saying, did he do enough for this to be who it is moving forward? Or do we still need to have a conversation? And to your point, if they do that, they're probably like flirting with 500. If he's playing really well and the receivers are coming along, the rookies, now maybe are we talking your fringe playoff team? I don't know. But the point I'm trying to make is the problem with a lot of the fans who have been with Shador long before he got drafted is you're inflating even what he is. And you need to let him just be. Let him learn it, because the thing I keep telling everybody, and people are going to push back on this, he was not comfortable. I can see it. I know what it looks like. I know what it means. And when he is comfortable, meaning he has a full grasp of the offense, he knows where his guys are going to be, and he's not playing hero ball, mm-hmm. we're going to see something that is actually – could work. And I think the bigger point here is for the Browns specifically, if Shador works, it changes the trajectory of the team.
Absolutely.
If he doesn't work out, now we're talking another 2 or 3 years and we got to figure out the quarterback situation. So every Browns fan should want him to work out.
Yeah.
But that's still a pretty big if, and I'll agree that there were definitely times last year where it did not look good.
Yeah.
So my point is just, I think the best course of action is if he works out.
Well, sure, sure. I mean, that's what every Browns fan has to be hoping for. Now, as we take a look here, and this is going to guide our look at some of the individual successes and failures in the NFL draft this year of some of the teams. The 2026 FDH and NFL post-draft rankings, find it on the main page at fantasydrafthelp.com. We have the different categories here. There is how teams did based on value. So it's the Jason Jones top 100. How many of the players did they get? How high up on the list were they? How did teams do at filling their needs? And then we have a composite between the two that I would argue is probably the most valuable one for looking at, and that is the combination of the value and the needs. And then we have an early ranking of the teams from 1 to 32 in the league, along with their remaining needs. Now, I will say that there are limitations to this part of it here, because under the way the system, the way that it works, if you addressed any of the needs on the Jason Jones top 100 and or if you took a player in the fourth round or above, then that counted as meeting the criteria here. So the Jets no longer show as needing a quarterback, even though I don't think old Cade is going to be the guy to get it done for them. And I talked about the earlier with my dad. I want to give equal time in my family here to my dear nieces, both of whom are big believers that Carson Beck is a fraud and a bust and will never amount to anything other than being a clipboard holder. Well, to them, I say, first of all, love you, fam. Can't wait to see you again. Second of all, totally agree. Totally agree. My nieces are correct on this one here. Arizona does not show as needing a quarterback here anymore, even though we know they didn't fill that hole. That's the reason that they are the leader in the clubhouse for the sweepstakes for Arch Manning for next year. So there are limitations here. You always have to take whatever the system is, right, and apply. You kind of give it the eye test, and you kind of see where there might be exceptions to the rule. But I'm just going to go through on this here. Generally speaking, what I do is to run through the top 10 and the bottom five in the different categories. So just looking at value, which is the first category on the sheet here, your top 10 in order. Number one, the New York Jets. Number two, Cleveland. Number three, the New York Giants. Four, Carolina. Five, Kansas City. Six, Tennessee. Seven, Las Vegas. Eight, Miami. Nine, Houston. 10, Baltimore. Looking at the bottom five, it is 28, Seattle. 29, Green Bay. 30, San Francisco. 31, Denver. 32, Jacksonville. Looking just at filling needs. Number one, Miami. Number two, the New York Giants. Number three is a three-way tie, Carolina, Cleveland, and the LA Chargers. Number six is the Jets. Seven is a tie between Buffalo and Detroit. Nine is a tie between Arizona, San Francisco, and Tennessee. The bottom five here, tied for 28th. It's the Rams and the Eagles. 30th is Las Vegas. 31st is Dallas. 32nd is Washington. By the way, paradoxically here, Dallas didn't do much to fill needs during the draft. I still think they were one of the big winners, and I'll get to that. I think because they've been patching needs this past offseason, and I think the players that they got, even if they weren't big needs, are going to be big difference makers. So to me, it's not even – I'm generally associated with the philosophy of filling needs, but there are exceptions to every rule, and I think Dallas was one of them. On the value and the needs, the unified theory, as it were, top 10, number one, the New York Jets, number two, Cleveland, number three, Miami, number four, the New York Giants, five, Carolina, six, Tennessee, seven, Baltimore, eight, Kansas City, nine, Detroit, 10, Cincinnati, the bottom five, 28, LA Rams, 29, Green Bay, 30, Jacksonville, 31, Denver, 32, Washington. So, Jason, again, particularly when it comes to the value, there must not have been much surprise to you because we're basing this off of your top 100 overall. So your general thoughts on what these metrics show us about the winners and losers of this year's draft?
Well, all right, right off the top, you see some consistency, right?
Mm-hmm.
New York Jets in the top 10 on all three. Cleveland's up there. Miami's up there. So this is every year. This is a great indicator of what each team actually did without listing names. Now, what's interesting about this, and we spoke about this off air a little bit. I was tracking literally every single position group throughout the draft.
Mm-hmm.
And we're using my rankings just like we are here. And while my rankings aren't the end-all be-all to every team, it is, as we discussed earlier, within range of consensus, right? There's nobody like, okay, here's a great example. In the pre-show, we talked about Ted Hurst. I love Ted Hurst as a prospect, especially if you can look at him 2 to 3 years down the road. I still had him in the third round. I didn't like elevate him just because I like him a lot. Like, there's a range that we have to stay with. And as I was doing this, as the picks were coming off, value be darned. there were teams where you're looking and it's, you know, it's 5, 12, 18. Like, okay, that all makes sense. And then the next one's in the hundreds. So I was very curious to see what this report was going to look like as far as the value side. Now, what's interesting is as we look at it, you start thinking about names now. And you go, okay, well, the Giants got two in the top 10 or something. Two in the top 10 almost exactly, I think. Mm-hmm. The Jets did well with their first-round picks. We talked about this also. I don't want to drag Miami, but I can't I can't say that I love everything they did either.
Jekyll and Hyde, baby. Jekyll and Hyde.
Right, because there are names there that I love as prospects, but the whole totality of it is still a little confusing. So as we look at this, it's playing out exactly like I thought it would. There's going to be teams that people talk about on TV that are going to say, oh, this team did great. But then if you filter it through this, like, well, it was solid. It wasn't great. And this gets into the whole needs versus BPA and all that. But we can't be ridiculous about this either. Whether we're talking about San Francisco or Green Bay, those are teams that took some reaches. Those are also historically successful teams. Mm-hmm. So maybe they're just cherry picking for need, and that's the best course of action for them. Then you have people that say you should always go best player available, damn need, no matter what. Well, it's neither of those. There's a nice mix in between.
Best player available out of your needs. How hard is it, people? It's not rocket science. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
For example, if we look at Cleveland, just because that's fresh in my mind, and we look in the top 10, let's say they didn't trade back, right? And let's say they had a tackle they liked 20 to 40. Would it have been the worst thing in the world for them to draft Downs, who is not a need, but we need a second impactful safety in there, in that mix somewhere, so it's not an urgent need? Or if they took Sonny Styles, you go, okay, well, you're betting on a freak athlete that could be more than what he is now. And so you can make an argument, that's okay. But like if they took a defensive end, like a hand in the dirt defensive end, I'm gonna go, all right, what are we doing? Right? You got the sack king on the other side. How important was this when your offense is awful? So yeah, there's a blend. It's the whole how much of the draft is art, how much of it is science. Well, it's both. It's more science than art, but it's a mix of both.
Yes, absolutely. And to expound on my earlier point about Dallas just briefly, that again, they didn't come into the draft with a whole lot of needs. And to be able to get a guy like Downs in there, who we said on the pre-draft show, you had a higher grade on even than Emenwari, and that's even knowing who Emenwari is now with the kind of year that he had. And I've talked about this ad nauseum on the show. The kind of player, generally speaking, a safety who can not only come in there and play at a Pro Bowl level, but just be such a glue guy that he makes those around him better. And that's what Emenwari did on Seattle as a rookie, maybe the most instrumental part of the whole freaking defense. And it was a historically great defense last year. Dallas, again, no longer stars and scrubs. They have quietly kind of patched a bunch of the holes as we've gone along here. So even if safety wasn't a huge need for them, to get a guy like that can lift up everybody there, and Dallas still, yes, it does have star power on defense. Oh, boy, that is going to be something to behold for a long time to come. And Chris and I talked about this off air. He noticed this before I did. Jason, from a storyline standpoint, we're going to be talking about this well into the 2030s in the NFC East, which is, of course, one of the glamour divisions in football as far as the way the media treats it. The three Ohio State guys, Reese, Styles, and Downs, going in that division. And arguably now being the most important player on each of those defenses, we're going to be hearing about this for years to come at 4:25 on Sunday afternoons in this division, because these are all three of these teams are teams on the rise. Make no mistake about it. They're not all playoff teams this year. I'm slotting Dallas as a playoff team right now. I think Washington and the Giants will be not far behind, but enough behind for this year. Beyond this year, maybe look out for both of them. But that's my thoughts on that.
I don't have any issues with it, but. Mm-hmm. Pump the brakes a little bit. I'm not prepared to hear "We Them Boys" this early in the calendar.
The fan base is annoying. We all know this. They're also all Laker fans and Yankee fans and Duke fans. I get it, but I mean, I have to call.
I am not fans of those other teams.
You're actually a UNC guy. You might be the only UNC Cowboys crossover in existence. You probably are. Most of them are Duke fans, you must admit. But, I figured that would bait Chris when I made that point there. But, you know, all right. So I've given you a lot to chew on, Chris, from both my Cowboy fan take and everything else. And react to that and everything that Jason said. Anything that jumps out at you?
I chuckled because watching it unfold, it was the Buckeye arms race in the NFC East.
Yes.
And that was kind of fun, right? I mean, and the media hasn't really picked up on it yet, but they will. When we get into the season. I take no umbrage with anything either one of you gentlemen have said about best player available at need in terms of that matrix. Obviously, they don't say it, but that's what teams have done forever. They say, like, oh, we don't draft for need. They all draft for need, right? You can't just go, I'm going to take the best player available, so we're going to go ahead and take, you know, Arvell Reese and we have Myles Garrett. Why would you do that, right? To Jason's point, the most glaring need on the Cleveland Browns roster was left tackle. Just a black hole. One of the most important positions on a football team. They had literally no one. Well, right. Look what they did, right? In terms of understanding value, and to Jason's point about moving up and moving down, I mean, Andrew Berry, this draft, did a great job of moving down, getting Fanoe, right? Picking up assets with that other pick in the third round from Kansas City. He got Barber the tackle out of Florida. He got two left tackles by moving down three spots. And so, you know, he got a kid out of Florida who might be their future swing tackle. So it was like, boom. You know, he's making things happen and understanding where his need is. And it was interesting to me that he understood the assignment, where I don't think San Francisco did. I don't think some other teams understood the assignment. When he talked about how he didn't expect that run on tight ends in the third round, that started. And it was clear to me when they dropped down out of the fourth, when Delp went right before them, that was who they were going to take. Mm-hmm. And they bailed out because he left in that spot before. Yeah. And he admitted, I didn't see that. I didn't read that right. I didn't see that coming. So mm-hmm. there you go back to the original point when we started this entire conversation about understanding the board, understanding value, understanding how other teams value and where and what they are likely to draft and where they are likely to draft it is a big part of the assignment. I look at your rankings, and again, I haven't spent the time to go through and sort of numerically, you know, analyze all these teams the way you already have, but my impressions, you know, early on were, you know, drafts I really liked were obviously the Browns, you know, the Giants. I love what the Cowboys did. I loved what the Panthers did. Unfortunately, always the Ravens seemed to do a pretty good job. Yeah. I liked what the Titans did. You know, and then there were the teams I didn't understand what the hell was happening, right? I mean, Jaguars, Rams, 49ers, Vikings, you know, there were Falcons. I don't know what was going on there. Didn't care for most of it. So, and I look at your rankings, and if you scan up and down there, I mean, teams I liked just instinctively, right? There they are at the top. And then the teams that I was thinking about, you know, if you pan down a little bit, you know, there they are, like teams I didn't care for. Although I will say I did kind of like what the Saints did, but you have them a little lower there. But some of those teams I didn't care for, Jacksonville, San Francisco, they're at the bottom. They're down there. And a lot of these teams, there were individual spots that I liked what they did in one particular round. And then I had question marks on everything else that they were doing. But again, I think we're going to see a lot more, back to the earlier part of this conversation, a lot more reaching as in these later rounds, in terms of maybe reaching isn't the right way to phrase it. Maybe it's more grasping, feeling around in the dark might be the better way to phrase that. I think we're going to see more of that. And I felt like we saw a bunch of that rounds 4 through 7 in this draft. And I think your rankings really reflect that.
I think so. And this is a thing where, again, if you are somebody who lives in the Jacksonville area that loves both great pro wrestling and the Jaguars, you never get to have both things at once, apparently, right? AEW has had this great renaissance in the last year, finally, after a couple of years. By the way, even at their worst, so much better than the Fed slop out there. But again, and you look at what they've done in the period of time since then with the Jaguars, there's some thought that Tony Khan, there's always speculation as to how involved he is with the Jaguars operations. He's head of their analytics department. He famously likes to talk about how he discovered who was the guy a couple of years ago? Robinson, the rookie, the running back, the undrafted free agent. But like Jacksonville, as AEW's fortunes have risen, the Jaguars, nobody's talking about this except for what Chris just did. What a just comatose offseason they've had. And we talk about this on the show all the time. If you're not moving forward, you're moving backwards. And that's to me why, again, you know, if you're one of the teams that still has a quarterback vacancy, for example, which the Jaguars don't have, they're prepared to go forward with Trevor Lawrence. But even the teams that didn't draft quarterbacks out there, okay, Minnesota brings in Kyler Murray. That's at least an upgrade over what they had. I love what my Dolphins did with getting Malik Willis in there. I'm a believer in him. So it's like there are teams aside from the Raiders that addressed quarterback in the offseason. So if you still have a vacancy at quarterback, a glaring one, you've taken a big step backwards. And you can't point to any specific thing with the Jaguars roster. You can't really point to any areas of concern. I mean, aside from, I mean, I feel like they always underrated, never quite knew what to do with Travis Etienne. So I think they're going to feel that loss more than they think they're going to. But it's a thing where they are one of the stealth big step back stories of the league for next year. You hear a thing that the wise guys love to talk about. This is one of these smart mark things here. The plexiglass principle. Teams that, like, if they take a big jump up in 1 year, they're fated. You know, if you've gained more than 4 wins in 1 year, you will refund that and possibly then some the next year. I find that to be very reductive, generally speaking. It's all based on how you go from there. What the Jaguars have done after their breakthrough season, I am entirely unimpressed with. And I think there's a chance that they get lapped by Tennessee in this division. Tennessee's had a very nice offseason. So I think, again, just in looking at this, you have teams that are going to be, again, if you haven't addressed the needs that you have, you're going to be in rough shape. I will say, though, you will notice here, there are teams at the bottom of the draft that don't have, or bottom, not the draft, bottom of my rankings in the furthest right corner. If you're checking this out either on the video feed of the show or if you have this form in front of you, not a lot of needs for remaining for the Jets, Browns, Dolphins, or for Arizona. Although, as I said before, quarterback should still be a need there. I had to erase it based on the rules of the game as I was scoring this here. But I want to point to this part here too, that teams have done a better job of filling needs. That after the 2021 draft, teams at that point had 5.03 holes on average. That dropped to 4.97 the next year, 4.4 in 2023, 3.97 in 2024, 3.88 in 2025, and it drops now to 3.69 needs. So I think it's a thing where even the worst teams are doing a better job of filling holes. And you've got the Rams, who I've got second overall. And we'll talk about this here with Seattle and the Rams. We'll talk about the top of the standings here, as it were, in a second. The Rams have 7 needs. But remember, they won the Super Bowl a couple of years back, I said, as the greatest Stars and Scrubs team in NFL history. This is what the Rams do. The Rams are somehow or another able to be the exception to the rule in this way.